The Democrats Debate, Part 1, and Young People Speak Out on Climate Change. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for June 27th, 2019, Thursday. It was a mixed decision on Thursday by the United States Supreme Court, which had Chief Justice John Roberts swinging between the liberal and conservative wings of the court to rule on two contentious issues that may affect the 2020 election, as well as many others for years to come. Both decisions decided 5-4 by the divided court, the first handing entrenched political parties in each state control over how political districts are drawn to ensure the victory of like-minded politicians, and the other, a darling of President Trump, that would have concluded an intimidating question on citizenship in the upcoming census. In a stinging defeat to Trump, the court blocked his contentious citizenship question planned for the 2020 census because officials gave what the court said was a contrived rationale and prompted Trump to suggest an extraordinary delay in the constitutionally mandated population count. And in a major blow to election reformers, the court rejected efforts to rein in partisan gerrymandering that critics have said warps democracy. The justice, in a landmark 5-4 ruling that could reverberate through U.S. politics for years to come, ruled for the first time that federal judges do not have the authority to curb partisan gerrymandering, a decision that could embolden state lawmakers to intensify use of the practice. The court ruled along ideological lines in the decision written by Chief Justice John Roberts, with its conservative members in the majority and liberals in dissent. The court sided with Republican lawmakers in North Carolina and Democratic legislators in Maryland, who drew electoral district boundaries that were challenged by voters as so politically biased that they violated rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. Though both parties have engaged in partisan gerrymandering, President Donald Trump's fellow Republicans have been the primary beneficiary since the last round of redistricting following the 2010 census. On the issue of the citizenship question, conservative Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the 5-4 ruling, joined by the court's four liberals, making it difficult for the Trump administration to add the query, even if officials offer a new explanation for its need, with the clock ticking toward the deadline for printing the census forms. Critics have called the citizenship question a Republican ploy to scare immigrants into not taking part in the population count and benefiting non-Hispanic whites and helping Trump's fellow Republicans gain seats in the U.S. House of Representatives and state legislators. The campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C., was a plaintiff in the gerrymandering suit and wrote a brief opposing the citizenship question. The organization's vice president is Paul Smith. He says the court ruled that gerrymandering is a political question outside the powers of federal courts.
It was admitted that when they designed it, they were doing a partisan gerrymander, which means they designed it to maximize the number of Republicans and minimize the number of Democrats elected. They told the map drawer, we want to have 10 Republicans go to Washington and 3 Democrats, and that's the map he drew, and that's the result that's happened in all the elections since. And our position is, it's not democracy to decide in advance how the elections are going to come out, despite how people vote.
But what was sort of its judicial history up till now?
Well, these cases are tried in front of a special trial court of 3 federal judges, and they had a full trial, and all 3 agreed that the map was unconstitutional. But that was reversed today by 5-4.
Yeah, so tell us about that decision.
It's not that the court said that this kind of practice of skewing democracy is constitutional or good. They said that we don't have a meaningful standard for deciding when the amount of political bias in the map goes too far. They said we have a line-drawing problem, an argument that I find have always found unpersuasive, and certainly I think the dissent, Justice Kagan, skewers it pretty well. But that's the holding, that there's no manageable standard.
They said it was a political problem. What do they mean by that?
Right. Well, there's a doctrine called the political question doctrine that says there are certain practices, even if they're illegal, that can't be fixed by the federal courts. And the court said this is one of them. Because we let legislators do these line drawing, we're going to assume that they're going to have a little bit of politics in everything they do. We're not going to expect them to be polypure. And once you allow that, the court said, we have a line drawing problem, not because we need to know when going too far happens, and how do we tell.
What they're saying is that the line drawing problem has to do with who's in power, and who's in power is a political question, and that's where it's supposed
right,
to happen.
Right, and they're saying that the lines themselves can cause bias, but a little bit of bias, the court says, is okay. But once you say a little bit is okay, then how much bias is too much bias?
Now, I've seen there's been accusations of gerrymandering on the other side as well. I mean, I live in New York City, and people have accused people of gerrymandering in a place where Democrats run in primary elections.
There's gerrymandering all over the place, and the other case that was decided today was a Democratic gerrymander out of Maryland, where they drew a map that gave the Democrats 7 out of 8 seats in Congress from Maryland. So it's a bipartisan problem. It happens that most of the more severe gerrymanders in recent years have been pro-Republican because they've been very good at getting control of the legislatures at the right time. But there's nothing magical about that.
Is there a conspiracy? Is there a Republican conspiracy? I've heard reference to that they're trying to take over the Congress by doing this. And
it is certainly true that they have an advantage in Congress right now because of the gerrymandered congressional maps in a lot of states. And North Carolina is one of them, but there are a number of others, Ohio, Michigan. I don't know if I would say there's a conspiracy. Certainly there has been a very organized effort out in the open by the Republicans to make sure they control legislatures in key states at the right time. We're going to have all these maps redrawn again in 2021 after the census, and so everybody's going to try very hard to be in control of the state legislatures that year as well.
Let's transition to the next decision that came out today, another sort of momentous decision on the census question to ask if the person being counted is a citizen or not.
What the court held there, Chief Justice Roberts switching over and voting with the more liberal justices, 5-4, was that the district court that had thrown out the citizenship question was right to say that the explanation for what the Commerce Department was doing was a pretext. It wasn't true. The Secretary of Commerce had said, well, we need this citizenship data to help for enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. And the record made clear that was a pretext they came up with long after they had decided to put the question on the census. The decision barring the citizenship question was allowed to stand. They may try again after this decision to come up with a different explanation, and we'll see what happens then.
Do you think they're going to actually delay the census or delay making the ballots, the census questionnaires, because of this?
I don't. It's a pretty massive undertaking, the census. It's critical for 1,000 different governmental operations, including, of course, deciding how many seats in Congress each state gets. And so delaying it any significant amount would interfere with all sorts of important stuff. It would be terrible. And so I don't imagine anybody's going to seriously take seriously that idea, although I know the president mentioned it in a tweet.
So you don't think that this census is going to include the citizenship question?
We may see some efforts over the next couple of months from the Commerce Department to invent a new rationale for putting it on there. And so we could have some emergency action over the summer in the Supreme Court. But I don't think they're going to delay the census.
So what happens, just to wrap up, what happens next as far as these issues of gerrymandering and census questions? They seem to be related questions. If it's not going to be solved by the courts, where are these problems going to be worked out?
Well, the gerrymandering problem is apparently not going to be solved by the federal courts. You can still sue in state court. The other thing that's happening is we have a real massive political insurgency that's saying we're not going to stand for this practice anymore. And people are putting it on the ballot around the country, trying to force the state constitutions to be amended to have these lines drawn, the district lines drawn by independent commissions. And so you're going to see more of that happening in 2020. It's really, and I think the decision of the Supreme Court not to address gerrymandering will fire up the opposition even more. The census, the courts did get involved and barred an inappropriate question, one that would have probably prevented many millions of people from answering the census. And so I think that was a case where judicial intervention was a good idea, and it looks like it'll probably stand.
Paul Smith is the vice president of the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. The census launch date, April 1st, is written into federal law called the Census Act, known as Title 13. To delay the 2020 census without running afoul of federal law would require Congress to change the law. Trump wrote on Twitter, "Today I have asked the lawyers if they can delay the census, no matter how long, until the United States Supreme Court is given additional information from which it can make a final and decisive decision on this very critical matter. Delaying the census by executive action would be unprecedented." And tonight is the second Democratic Party debate in Miami, pitting a slate of candidates vying for the chance to unseat Trump next year. Last night, candidates battled it out on foreign policy, the economy, the environment, and immigration. At some points, providing humorous moments is when the microphones in the control booth went live, and others, angry exchanges over questions of war and peace. Tonight, a new gaggle of wannabe candidates will take the stage at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, including progressive favorite Bernie Sanders. WBAI's Linda Perry has this report recapping day one of the debates.
The first of two Democratic presidential debates took place in Miami last night, not far from Parkland, Florida, where in February of 2018, a gunman opened fire with a semi-automatic rifle at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. He killed 17 students and staff members and injured 17 others. NBC moderator Chuck Todd said the shooting started a lot of gun activism. He asked Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, with hundreds of millions of guns on the streets, what's the role of the federal government?
Seven children will die today from gun violence, children and teenagers. And they won't just die in mass shootings. They'll die on sidewalks, they'll die in playgrounds, they'll die in people's backyards. Gun violence is a national health emergency in this country, and we need to treat it like that. So what can we do? We can do the things that are sensible. We can do the universal background checks. We can ban the weapons of war. But we can also double down on the research and find out what really works.
Former HUD Secretary Julian Castro says he's the dad of a 10-year-old girl.
The worst thing is knowing that your child might be worried about what could happen at school, a place that's supposed to be safe. We don't have to accept that.
Castro says the activists of Parkland and Moms Demand Action, who have risen up across the United States, have inspired so many people. And he says although we have not yet seen legislative action, we're getting closer to passing common sense gun reform. Congressmember Tim Ryan of Ohio says we need to deal with the trauma our kids are experiencing.
We need social and emotional learning in every school. 90% of the shooters who do school shootings come from the school they're in, and 73% of them feel shamed, traumatized, or bullied.
Ryan says if our kids are so traumatized they're going into a school with a gun, then we're doing something wrong. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota has a specific way that she looks at proposed gun regulations.
Does this hurt my Uncle Dick and his deer stand, coming from a proud hunting and fishing state? These proposals don't do that. When I was a prosecutor, I supported the assault weapon ban. When I was in the Senate, I saw those moms from Sandy Hook come and try to advocate for change, and we all failed. And then now these Parkland kids from Florida, they started literally a national shift. You know why? It's just like with gay marriage. When kids talk to their parents and their grandparents, they say, I don't understand why we can't put these sensible things in place. They listen.
There's one thing we don't all agree with when it comes to guns, and I think it's common sense, and over 70% of Americans agree with me.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker.
If you need a license to drive a car, you should need a license to buy and own a firearm. And not everybody in this field agrees with that, but in states like Connecticut that did that, they saw 40% drops in gun violence and 15% drops in suicides. We need to start having bold agendas on guns. Look.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
I run the largest police force in America, too, and if we're going to stop these shootings, we're going to get these guns off the street, we have to have a very different relationship between our police and our community. I also want to say there's something that sets me apart from all my colleagues running in this race, and that is for the last 21 years, I've been raising a black son in America. And I have had to have very, very serious talks with my son, Dante, about how to protect himself on the streets of our city and all over this country, including how to deal with the fact that he has to take special caution because there have been too many tragedies between our young men and our police, too, as we saw recently in Indiana. So we need to have a different conversation in this country about guns, but also a different conversation about policing that brings police and community together. We've done that in New York City, and we've driven down crime while we've done it.
Apart from gun reform, most of the candidates agree that climate change is one of the most important problems which need to be addressed. Another is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Ohio Representative Tim Ryan says the Democratic Party has a perception problem.
We are not connecting to the working class people in the very states that I represent, in Ohio, in the industrial Midwest. We've lost all connection. that we have got to change the center of gravity of the Democratic Party from being coastal and elitist and Ivy League, which is the perception, to somebody from the forgotten communities that have been left behind for the last 30 years, to get those workers back on our side so we can say we're going to build electric vehicles, we're going to build solar panels. But if you want to beat Mitch McConnell, this better be a working class party if you want to go into Kentucky and take his rear end out. And if you want to take Lindsey Graham out, you got to have a blue collar party that can go into the textile communities in South Carolina.
Ryan says if we don't connect with workers, white, black, gay, straight, working class people, none of the goals of the Democratic Party will get done. The second debate is this evening. It features more of the leading Democrats in this crowded field. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
And the GOP and Democratic Party aren't the only political organizations with skin in the 2020 game. Often sidelined, but always feisty, the Green Party has been fielding candidates despite being left out of most debates. A candidate for the Green Party nomination is New York's own Howie Hawkins. He says the candidates didn't spend enough time on the most crucial questions.
That was the Democratic primary, so I really couldn't demand entrance there. But in a general election, it's an issue because it's a private commission now that determines the presidential debates. It's called the Commission on Presidential Debates. It sounds like a government agency. In fact, it's a jointly owned nonprofit corporation of the Democratic and Republican parties.
If you had a chance to debate, what would you have to say on some of these issues, these hot button issues?
I thought the most interesting question was at the end. They said, what's your top issue? And some people gave name two. And as far as I'm concerned, Tulsi Gabbard got one of them. That's the danger of nuclear war. Both Russia and the United States are putting tactical nukes in the conventional battlefields, and they're getting out of these nuclear treaties. So that's an existential threat. The other one, of course, is climate change. Booker came close, but he called it nuclear proliferation, as if North Korea is the problem. Right now, it's the major nuclear powers, including the United States. So I'm saying on the nuclear question, we should unilaterally disarm to a minimum credible deterrent and go from there for complete disarmament through negotiation, mutual disarmament. Because right now, we could have an accident, get a war started, and nuclear winter would kill us all.
And climate was brought up as a second issue by a number of the candidates. What's your position on that?
Our signature program for the last decade has been the Green New Deal. The problem is it's been picked up by Ocasio-Cortez and Markey in the Senate, and they watered it down. So they don't say we have to ban fracking and new fossil fuel infrastructure. If we don't do that, we're locked in for another 3 or 4 decades in the fossil fuel burning. It's too late. They extended the deadline from 2030 to 2050 to zero out greenhouse gas emissions, which, again, is too late. And they won't touch the military budget, which is where we're going to get the resources to convert our economy to clean energy. Just like during World War II, the federal government built or took over a quarter of manufacturing in order to turn industry on a dime into the arsenal for democracy that defeated the fascists. We got to do the same kind of scale operation to defeat climate change. So I think they're all falling well short of what's required.
There was a lot of talk about cap and trade. What do you think of this idea of carbon neutral or carbon buying up carbon pollution credits and things like that?
That's just an excuse to keep polluting. We've got to have hard caps on how much can be emitted with deadlines for converting different sectors of the economy to clean energy. We said no new construction that's not zero emissions by 2020, and then no new cars sold in the state that are not zero emissions by 2025. That's the kind of thing we've got to do if we're going to cut the emissions and just tell industry you got to adapt by a date certain. The carbon offset, so you get this carbon neutral idea, is you can plant some trees in Brazil that supposedly offset the carbon you're emitting here. It doesn't reduce carbon emissions. It just says you're going to emit here, and then they're going to soak up the carbon someday in the future when those trees grow up. And it's not an effective way. We've had that, and it hasn't worked in reducing emissions.
Why is the Green Party important if there's progressives like Bernie Sanders running as Democrats?
Well, Bernie called himself a socialist. He's really an old-fashioned liberal. Socialism was social ownership and democratic administration, a major means of production. And if we don't do that, then there'll still be a billionaire class, and that concentrated wealth, economic power will translate into concentrated political power. So even the programs that I support, that Bernie wants to do, like Medicare for All, tuition-free college can be attacked. Look at New York. We had tuition-free in New York City, City University in New York, tuition-free from 1848 till 1976. Then we had an economic crisis, and the bankers said, you can't do that anymore. Until we take power from them by democratizing ownership of the wealth of this country, we're not going to get what we need. So we got to go way beyond what Bernie Sanders is talking about. Real democratic socialism, not just social programs.
Howie Hawkins is candidate for the Green Party nomination for President of the United States. And meanwhile, young people were especially interested in how candidates plan to deal with climate change, an issue that may outlive most of the adults who created the problem and have so far failed to come up with meaningful solutions. Shia Patrick is a climate justice activist. She says climate change is more than just one issue.
I actually don't think they're doing enough. They're saying that climate change and the climate crisis is a single issue area, and they're not understanding that this includes healthcare, immigration, and so many other issues, so they don't want to have a debate on it. Last night, they talked about climate change for 7 minutes, and it's just not enough to address the crisis that we're living in. I do understand that they are considering it, but we need a climate debate, and they're not giving that to us. And this is time-sensitive. We have 11 years to reverse everything that's happening if we want a livable future. The government has known that the fossil fuel industry is going to ultimately increase global warming, and they've known this for around 40 years, and they have not done anything about it. This is a generational issue that's going to affect youth and our children the most, and they're thinking about their own profit without thinking about our future.
What led you to get involved in climate change and into politics?
I was born and raised in Mexico. I moved to New York City 3 years ago, and I moved here because there was a drought and flooding where I lived back in Mexico, and everything was really unstable. The prices of food were really unstable, and that was just what pushed my family to move away. But when I got to New York City, I saw the effects that the Sandy hurricane had on the community, and that's when I realized that climate change is everywhere, all around the world. You can't escape it, so you have to face it, and you have to fight you have to fight for climate justice. And so because I am Latina, and because I saw the firsthand effects of climate change, I decided to get politically involved. And even if I'm not originally from New York, I think that this is an international issue. So wherever you are, wherever I am, I'm going to do what I can to fight for climate justice.
And tonight is part two of the debate. What do you expect to hear from the candidates? What would you want to hear from the candidates?
I'm watching the debate with Sunrise Movement, and right now I'm really watching Jay Inslee and also Bernie Sanders, because I think they are the most progressive when it comes to climate change. Also Elizabeth Warren, of course. So I'm looking at how they are going to talk about it and the other candidates' reactions to it.
Do you have hope that you're going to hear something you want to hear tonight?
I do, and I don't want any cap-and-trade policy, because that does not work. I want bold action. I want New York City declared a climate emergency yesterday, and I want to see that reflected in the debate. I want to see that candidates are taking this issue seriously, and they're determined to take bold action to address it.
Great. Anything you'd like to add?
On September 20th, there's going to be a global strike for climate justice. I'm with Fridays for Future, and we're organizing a student worldwide strike, and we want adults to join us. This is going to be advertised, and it's going to be very big. Youth are leading the movement right now, but we need politicians, and we need adults to get involved.
Shia Patrick is a climate justice activist, and she says climate change is more than just one issue. And former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke answered a question about marginal tax rates in Spanish, U.S. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey showed off his Spanish skills while discussing his ideas on immigration reform. Former U.S. Housing Secretary Julian Castro, who is Mexican-American, gave part of his closing statement in Spanish. The Democratic presidential hopefuls peppered their statements with Spanish on Wednesday night in Miami during the first televised debate of the 2020 election, evoking praise from some Latino activists and eye rolls from others. Their efforts were a testament to the fact that Latinos are on track to be the largest minority racial or ethnic group eligible to vote in 2020, with 32 million, according to figures from the Pew Research Center. That amounts to about 13% of the electorate, and the population is strong in such key states as Arizona, Florida, and Colorado. And now, we introduce WBAI commentator Milton Alamadi.
Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Salman, a good friend of Donald Trump, is a weapon of mass destruction. He's conducting a genocidal war in Yemen, stoking the Libya anarchy, and last year eliminated prominent journalist and regime critic Jamal Khashoggi. Now he's reared his ugly head in Sudan. In April, Sudan dictator General Omar Hassan Bashir's 30 years regime was overthrown in a popular revolution led by women, students, workers, the professional classes, and intelligentsia. It was carried out with minimal bloodshed as the country's economy tanked. Due to Bashir's militarism, the foreign debt rose to over $10 billion. 70% inflation meant staples such as bread became unaffordable. The revolution was a warning to other African tyrants like Uganda's General Museveni. The Saudis also trembled. Suddenly in June, uniformed gunmen slaughtered Sudanese. More than 100 were killed, several dozens injured, and women and men raped. Why such bloodletting after removing Bashir? The killers belonged to a state militia called the Rapid Support Forces, commanded by General Mohamed Dagalo, vice president in the Transitional Military Council. Dagalo once commanded the Janjaweed, state militia accused of genocidal killings during the Darfur conflict of 2003 to 2009. His boss, Bashir, was indicted by the International Criminal Court for those crimes. Today, Dagalo's puppet master is Prince Salman. The Saudis bankrolled Bashir's regime. Bashir allows Sudanese boys as young as 14 to go fight in Yemen. These children are enticed with $10,000 payments to their families. In a country with average income of less than $5,000, it's big money, especially in these times. Saudis fear a new Sudan would put an end to the child trafficking for mercenaries. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy has proposed resumption of negotiations and for civilians to play a leading role in the transition. The protesters agree. The generals refuse. Social media have been cut, but demonstrators promise to return to the streets in full force unless their demands are met. Will Dagalo and Donald Trump's friend, Prince Salman, unleash their killers again? Sudanese soldiers and generals must not allow this. They must side with the people of Sudan. They must remove Dagalo. This is Milton Alamadi, Black Star News, and this is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI, New York.
Standing at the crossroads, trying to read the signs, to tell me which way I should go to find the answer, and all the time I know. Plant your love and let it grow.
Let it grow, let it grow. Let it blossom, let it flow. In the sun, the rain, the snow.
And that's some of the news for Thursday, June 27th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Milton Alamadi. Our engineer is James Ursay, also our music director. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.
To get a friend that I can count on, there's nothing left. to show. Plant your love and let it grow.
Let it grow, let it grow.
Up very shortly, Justice Matters with Bob Ganji. Stay with us.
In the sun, the rain, the snow.